Rewards programs are a lot like pop culture. They can be hard to keep up with. But with Venmo's new rewards program, Venmo Stash, rewards are so easy because the more you do, the more you get. And you choose the bundle of brands you get cash back at. It's giving fiscal queen. It's giving star. It's giving up to 5% cash back at your favorite brands. Just pick a bundle of your go-to spots to shop with your Venmo debit card and earn cash back at them. Do more, get more with Venmo Stash. The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. Venmo Stash bundle terms and exclusions apply. Max $100 cash back per month. See terms at venmo.me/stash terms.
My perfect day has sand, salt water, and friends. But my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can take me out of the moment. Now I'm all in with clearer skin thanks to Skyrizi. Risankizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150-milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. With Skyrizi, most people saw 90% clearer skin and many were even 100% plaque-free at 4 months. Skyrizi is just 4 doses a year after 2 starter doses.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions, increased infections, or lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, get checked for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor about any flu-like symptoms or vaccines.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin. And that means everything. Nothing is everything. Ask your doctor about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis. Visit Skyrizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
Network. The views and opinions expressed by hosts and listeners on the Astonishing Dead Letter Office are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Astonishing Legends Productions, the Astonishing Legends Network, or any affiliated entities or guests.
When something unexplainable happens to you, it can make you feel isolated or alone. But trust us, you're not. For over a decade, you've been sending your strange stories to Astonishing Legends. And now it's time for our fellow legenders to hear them too. Join us weekly in Blanket Fortiana as we dig through your intriguing messages to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Tonight's episode, Something's Watching.
You know, Forrest, there's a specific kind of silence during the early 70s. Mm. Not just the absence of noise. It was like I don't know. If you remember, I'm presuming you do, but it was like an analog sort of quietness when you were out in the woods. The world was a different place before the internet, before 24-hour cable. There was like 3 channels in the woods behind your house. That wasn't just nature. It was a frontier, you know, to be explored, a playground, a thin place. It's spooky. It's exciting. It's fun. It's all of that stuff all at once.
Look who's opened up a giant bag of philosophical worms here. Well, yes. The things you just mentioned are fascinating in that you had to be there. You had to live through it because you'll never get that back. And I feel sad for the youth of today.
For today's youth.
Because they'll never know that. It depends. If you have to purposely get away from it and tune out, but that's all they know. And so the things I read about, they never knew about this, the small pleasures, the duet of pleasures that we just embrace because we had nothing else. So you're talking about nature, and I think that's the difference, is that we were just outside more because we were inside a lot, and it depends on where you grew up. You know, that old hypothesis why Seattle has produced such great music is because the weather's crummy, it's constantly raining, all winter it's a 40-degree drizzle, and so kids are inside, they're watching TV.
Right.
The idea, though, is that you got out and saw the world, you stomped on the terra, and you weren't looking at a screen the whole time, so there is a different kind of noise that happens digitally that's constantly in your head now. But the silence you're talking about is, just the sounds of nature and getting out. And so when you think about a kid in that era, you know, the world is massive. And it's massive in a different way than it is now. Now you can look up anything from any corner of the world. You can interact and talk to people from halfway around the world, which was harder to do back then. It was possible when we were growing up, but much harder to do. And now you're flooded with everything on the planet. And does that make it better? Well, it depends on how you use it. So there's no Google Maps to look at everything. In fact, I think people now are still just as ignorant about geography as they were then. But if you lived in a town like Mogador, Ohio, which has an interesting naming history behind it, we're going to talk about later, your universe was basically your yard and the fields and whatever streets you rode your bike down, and that was it. That's your universe.
Again, folks, here we are talking about Ohio in the 70s. That is a lightning rod for the paranormal when you think about it. The 1973 Ohio Valley UFO flap happening around this time period. Cryptids, we've talked about the Minerva Monster with Seth Breedlove, but people forget how many of these smaller personal encounters were happening at the same time. And these weren't all monsters and aliens on the 6 o'clock news. Sometimes they were just eyes in the dark.
That's right. It always comes down to the eyes, and not to be facetious, but yeah, it's the window to some soul or something soulless. And that's the thing. So when you're 5 years old, like our listener Michael was in the story, you don't have a category for cryptid. That's the other thing. So we didn't have the wheelhouse of knowledge back then. Yeah. And we talked about this quite a bit, even if you watch Twilight Zone. They had the concepts because this stuff's always been happening, but it's how you think about it and how you define it. And so when you have something that's supposed to be your safest place, your safest space, your bedroom, and that feeling of safety is breached, it changes how you see the world. And so what we're talking about here is worldview from a perspective. And yes, a small town monster indeed.
So Michael, the listener we're hearing from today, is a database administrator now. Hmm. He spends his life in numbers and medical science. He's a Fox Mulder skeptic, like I used to be before I went to Kansas. Hmm. But the math of his childhood bedroom in Mogador doesn't make sense to his logical mind.
It doesn't, but also children live in they're still in the world of fantastical possibilities.
That's
right. But this story isn't about a mere sighting of just some glowing eyes. It's about a 5-year-old boy performing a feat of strength that shouldn't be possible. Now, he doesn't really mention that too much. So listen carefully to the description because it's got what I would say when we do some readings. It's thrown away a bit.
All right. Tonight, we're looking through a window in the Ohio corridor. Whenever you're ready, Forrest.
I listened to your most recent episode of Astonishing Legends, episode 303, Seth Breedlove, Small Town Monster, and am compelled to reach out to you both and relate an experience I had as a small child living in the greater Akron area during the early 1970s. I don't think my experience is any more or less unique than other stories that have been related over the years in the paranormal realm, but I do feel like it synchronizes with similar experiences that have been reported by those that lived in this area of Ohio during the 1970s. I don't know the exact year nor the exact season, but this incident happened when I was 5 years of age, probably slightly younger. As a reference point, I was born late in the year during 1970. Although we lived in many places while we lived in Ohio, at this time we lived in a place called Mogador. The house we resided in was in a rural area of the town, as there were many trees or woods surrounding it. As I recall, it was a single-level ranch-style home positioned on a slight incline. If I were to stand in front of the house, the incline would start on the left side of the house, while there was more exposure of the brick foundation and where the windows of the house would have been higher to get to because of the incline making it, in effect, taller. This is an important detail to remember. The night of the incident, it was time for bed, and both my younger sister and I shared a bedroom, so we were both in the room that night. Our bedroom was adjacent to our parents' bedroom, and as I said, was situated on the left side of the house, where the incline was, and there was a single window in the bedroom. My sister's bed was against the wall near the window, while I was parallel to her on the wall opposite, near the door, with a better view of the window. The bedroom had a chest of drawers that was taller than me, resting against the wall opposite the ends of our beds. At some point during the night, I woke up with a feeling of fear and dread, with an intense feeling that I was being watched. When I looked over to the single window in the room, I saw a pair of red eyes moving back and forth, looking in the room for something or someone. I started to scream and jumped out of my bed, and instead of running out of the room, I locked the door. I was still screaming, "Help! Help!" And then my sister woke up, and she started screaming. While still positioned near the locked door, looking at the red eyes that were now staring at me, I grabbed the chest of drawers, which was larger and much heavier than me, and moved it in front of me so that I was sandwiched between the locked door and the dresser drawer. At this point, my parents woke up because of all the commotion and tried to get to our bedroom but could not because I had locked the door. My mom and dad started calling my name as I tried to get into the room. Bang! 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 The sound of my dad's hand slapped against the door. I and my sister continued screaming, with me peeking out from behind the chest of drawers to see if the red eyes were still there. They were. Bang! 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 The sound of my dad's hands again hitting the door. A few seconds later, I heard the doorknob being handled from the outside, and my dad had gone to get a screwdriver to open the door. It had one of those simple pop locks that if you pushed a solid piece of metal through the hole from the outside, the lock would unlock. My parents entered the room and wondered what all the commotion was about. I told them about the red eyes staring at us through the window, and they were shocked that I had moved the dresser in front of the door. They took both of us out of the room, and we went to my parents' bedroom. My dad went outside with a gun and a flashlight, going to the side of the house where the window to our bedroom was, and found nothing. The next morning, we all went outside around the house to where the window was at. My dad had a stepladder in tow. He opened up the stepladder under the window and climbed up. The stepladder was not very tall, and neither was my dad. He got up to about the third step, and that is where someone, or something, would have had to have been in order to stare into the window. I can only guess at this point, but it would have been approximately 24 inches taller than my dad in order to look into the window from the ground outside. Years later, we would all as a family recount this incident, often during autumn, in what is traditionally considered the spooky season here in the United States. The story would always be recounted as a simple statement of fact with the conclusion that we never knew what it was that stared into the window that night. My dad was a solid science guy, and he had no room for the paranormal in his life, despite suffering extreme trauma as a child. Both my parents are dead now, my mom passing away in 2011 and my dad in 2013. There are times that I lament that I can no longer recall this story with them, perhaps to get additional details that I may have forgotten over the years. It is one of two strange incidents that happened to us when we lived in Ohio. We left Ohio for Michigan in the summer of 1980, but Ohio has remained in my memory all these years later as some place where weird things happen. How ironic is it that in 2025, the word Ohio is used as Gen Z slang for weird? What prompted me to author this story and send it to Astonishing Legends after hearing the Seth Breedlove episode is that Seth mentioned growing up and having a strange experience in Minerva, Ohio. Having never heard of Minerva, Ohio, I Googled it and discovered that it was a mere 33 miles from Mogador, where I had the strange experience of the glowing red eyes. Are they related? It's impossible to tell. But the proximity of the towns and the sighting of some kind of beast makes me wonder if there was something going on in that part of Ohio. Before signing off, a little bit about myself to give context to the story. I work in the healthcare industry as a non-clinician at a large nonprofit healthcare organization as a database administrator. I interact with clinicians like nurses and doctors on medical data used in making decisions for the entire organization. I deal with numbers and medical science daily. I would consider myself sometimes an atheist, sometimes a Buddhist, but never a believer in any Abrahamic religion. I have, however, had a fascination with the paranormal my entire life. I do not believe in Bigfoot, however, and I often tell people who pose that question that I take a Fox Mulder approach to that subject. I want to believe. I am skeptical, but open to the fact that things happen to us during our lives that sometimes escape the realm of provable science, and at times impact our lives. Our journey into the shadows continues after this break.
Have you ever had one of those friends that still insists on doing things the hard way?
I'm sure we both know someone, and every friend circle has one. But I used to work at a film stage with this one friend, and every morning she would try to make toast, but it always ended up on fire. So I was getting tired of this happening every morning. So I told her, you know, the toaster has settings for how dark you want your toast. And she says, yeah, but I like my toast really dark. And I say, then just turn this dial and you can get your toast as dark brown as you want, but the toaster will pop up before the bread starts to burn. To which she replies, nah, I like my toast really dark. It was a real Spinal Tap, these go to 11 situation.
Yeah, those people are out there. We all have friends like that. We all know somebody like that, and especially our friends that still insist on overpaying for wireless in 2026. But thank goodness Mint Mobile is here to help with that. I think those friends don't want to switch just because they're afraid the quality won't be as good, or it'll be a hassle, or they really won't be saving much, so why bother? But Forrest and I can attest that none of that is true. Mint Mobile gives us great quality, great service, and great savings.
Indeed, all of that is true. You got to get out of that mindset of paying way too much for wireless just because that's how it's always been. Mint exists purely to fix that. Same coverage, same speed, just without the inflated price tag.
Mint Mobile is the premium wireless service you've come to expect. Unlimited talk, text, and data, but at a fraction of what others charge.
And right now, for a limited time, get 50% off 3, 6, or 12-month plans of unlimited premium wireless.
And there's no hassle, like we said. You can bring your own phone and number, activate with eSIM in minutes, and start saving immediately. No long-term contracts, no hassle.
With a 7-day money-back guarantee and customer satisfaction ratings in the mid-90s, Mint makes it easy to try it and see why people don't go back.
Yeah, we are never going back because we're enjoying all the same quality, if not better, and we're definitely saving a ton of dough and with much better customer service. So if you're ready to change your money-losing mindset and stop paying more than you have to, new customers can make the switch today and for a limited time, get unlimited premium wireless for just $15 a month.
Switch now at mintmobile.com/DLO.
That's mintmobile.com/DLO.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plan required. $15 a month equivalent.
Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only.
Over 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Capable device required.
Availability, speed, and coverage varies. Additional terms apply.
See mintmobile.com. And now back to the show.
All right, so let's start off at looking at this part of Ohio. Mm. Mogador and Minerva are about 33 miles apart. And for people who have not heard of Minerva, or maybe this is the first episode of our show you've ever heard, just look up the Minerva Monster. Mm-hmm. We did an episode with Seth Breedlove where he talks about it. He, of course, is the really good repository for that is his company, Small Town Monsters. They have produced many, many documentaries, but that's a good way to get familiar with the Minerva Monster. And Small Town Monsters is based in Ohio, of course. So, but 33 miles between these two towns where the Minerva Monster was and where this took place, Mogador, that's not that far apart if you think of like a migratory apex predator, right? Or whatever this thing was. It could have been out for an afternoon walk. Kind of a long one, but you never know.
No, I was about to say, there are animals that we know of in suburban settings that can cover that amount of territory in a day, foraging looking for food. So it's certainly doable, in my view, for a cryptid, an apex cryptid. But yes, Ohio, round on the ends and high strangeness in the middle. Well, from 1970 to 80, you could, I think, make a great argument for it being a high strangeness hotspot. So you had the Cuyahoga Valley sightings. Then you had the Minerva incidents in 1978, and it wasn't just Bigfoot. So again, check out Small Town Monsters back catalog and start with the classic original Small Town Monsters productions. It's so much fun to go through, for me, also chronologically.
Yes.
And also very inspiring and a terrific thing that they've grown so much and
yes,
has evolved. But yeah, check out the back catalog of investigative documentaries, because this time, for some reason, we could talk about why the kids think, as he says in the story, why the kids say, oh, that's so Ohio, for something being weird.
Yeah.
Are they tapping into some kind of zeitgeist? Well, it's a perfect place to do it because it's a cryptid-rich environment.
Indeed, it is. And the other thing that Michael mentions, in the rural ranch-style house, these kinds of houses, a lot of times they were built right up against second-growth forests that are reclaiming old farmland. And so you have this intersection of suburban safety and primeval woods. And when you get near those woods where something where it's been replanted, but it's also kind of old, it's sort of a perfect vibe for strangeness. It's like how you see when you look at TV shows or streaming shows where they're trying to have spooky woods, that's exactly what you're talking about there.
Well, that's interesting. Could you expound on that? Because your place in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, was a little bit like that?
Yeah, it was, and it wasn't. I mean, it had the Delaware River in the front, which was amazing, and there was a road, too.
Yeah,
We were on the river, but there was a very busy road between our house and then getting down to the river.
Folks in the West, like myself from the West, may not be able to picture this, but you had a barge canal carved out behind
you, back.
Right? So explain that a little bit.
So that was a canal that was left over from times when they would move coal and other things up and down on this canal that was man-made. It came all the way from, I think originally from Jersey City, which is 80 or more miles away.
Yeah.
And it went up along the Delaware, and I might be wrong about that. It might be that this one just went down to Philadelphia and up north, but I seem to remember that the whole thing connected. But the canal was still back there, and there was a towpath, which was maintained by a park system.
Right.
And the canal even had water in it, although it had been damaged by a flood during the time that we had our place, so it wasn't really deep enough to do anything fun in. It used to be people would canoe or tube down the river and then come back up in the canal, which had locks. And there was a working lock behind our house. But the whole thing was very spooky. And then at the very back of the property on the other side of the canal was a cliff with rocks that was probably at least 200 feet tall.
Oh, really?
With trees growing on it. Yeah. I mean, just
like you could
very,
die.
Very, very tall.
Like if you were out traipsing around.
Yeah, if you fell off of it. Yeah, very spooky. And then, of course, up at the top where it leveled off, there would be more homes back in, you know, in the distance. You couldn't see.
So there's a bit of a gorge, a bit of a ravine.
Yeah. And it was spooky. So, and there were a lot of woods around there, like what Michael's talking about here. And at night, it was creepy.
Yeah.
And I used to love it to sit outside, but never too far from the house because invariably you would hear something or it just didn't feel right. Or you just felt like you were being watched. And so, and it's a big Bigfoot sighting area. That was Bucks County.
Right,
but you know, it's like Bucks County and Ohio, in my mind, have very similar vibes.
Yeah, it's all really old areas. All of the earth is old. Okay, but I mean, as far as human population and settling and people experiencing things, because like I said, I've always said this, we may never know of all the paranormal things going on if you're not there to see it.
Right.
And so there is a major connection, in my view, to human beings in all this and the quote unquote, the larger, the phenomenon. It has to do with us.
Yes.
We are part of it. We are connected to it. So the longer people have been living in an area, I think obviously the more stories and lore you're going to get, but also there is a human interaction element to that. So, which is what the story is about, because you have something peeking in to see what the heck's going on in here. And not so much to frighten things, but or people, but that's what's happening, is that you're seeing a willful interaction for whatever reason. But a little bit about the history of the name. I'm just going to quickly read this paragraph.
Oh, yeah. I'm interested. I did not look into this.
Well, it's a what a great name. There's a reason it's a little strange, but it just very L-O-T-R, like Morgador, the depths of Mordor. So it's got some lore, Morgador does.
Is that your new podcast, Morgador lore?
That'd be a great one if you're really into it. So from the official website for the village of Morgador, MorgadorVillage.org. A little brief history here. It says, Morgador's first settler, Ariel Bradley, was only 9 years old when he was a spy for George Washington during the American Revolution. Born in Salisbury, Connecticut, Bradley came to the Western Reserve of Ohio and eventually settled in a small crescent-shaped valley with good timber and plenty of springs. That's the point I was getting at for you. You were surrounded by water, sir. Another element here. Plenty of springs, plenty of water.
Yeah.
And there in 1807, he built a log cabin. Let's see, he must be older than nine. Anyway, he built a log cabin there in 1807 on a tract of land costing $335. Wow, that's a bargain. I'll take two. And it contained about 146 acres. That's a good swatch. The town eventually became known as Bradleyville. And then in 1825, the name of the town would be changed through the unintentional act of a celebrating sailor. Mogador is an Arabic word meaning beautiful and the name of a town in Morocco. In 1825, a large home was built by Martin Kent Jr. Reportedly, when the rafters were all in place, one of the workers, a former sailor, climbed to the top of the structure, removed a flask of whiskey from his pocket, and christened the home Mogador. And there's always been a debate on why he chose the name Mogador. Some say the sailor had fond memories of trips to North Africa. Some have said that he had a good friend that had been captured by the Barbary pirates and was imprisoned in Old Mogador. And others have speculated that popular literature of that era was the Arabian Nights and the mysterious markets on the North African coast. So there you go.
Wow. While you were sharing that, I looked up Mogador. It's now called Essaouira.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even going to try. Essaoui. It has literally every vowel in it almost. Essaouira. I think it's Essaouira. That's what I'm going to go with.
You're talking about the town in Morocco.
Yeah, it used to be Mogador until the 60s. And then the name changed. But it's just beautiful. It looks like something out of an Errol Flynn movie or some other movie about colonialism. But it looks amazing.
In both anecdotes here, in both we have a young boy. One, Ariel Bradley. Imagine being 9 years old and spying for George Washington.
It's weird. That ties back to Bucks County for me, because when we were in Bucks County, there's a little town in New Jersey just on the other side of the river called Lambertville, which was about 25 minutes from our house there that we had. And there's one of Washington's spies is buried at a church there, along with one of his commanders, Coryell. The spy's named Sam Holcomb, so he was one of the first spies for. So I love that. When you think about that early spy network, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing, fascinating history.
A really, really rough event and period in history here. Check out the Ken Burns documentary on the American Revolution now playing.
Oh, God. You know, I never saw that one. I need to watch that.
Check it out. It's really well done. Of course, it's Ken Burns. But let's talk about his home base now, his place to feel safe. You know, ideally, that's what every kid's childhood bedroom is to them. But that lasts into adulthood, because how many stories have we come across where, that shrinks down. It's kind of like you're falling back, retiring in sections, as Michael Caine might say, when something's frightening you. So we're going to talk about the actions here in a little bit, but the threat is outside. You have the ramparts, the defensive barriers of the house itself and the window. Then you have your bedroom inside that, the inner sanctum, and then to protect as whatever is outside might be encroaching. Then you have the dresser as the last defense.
That's right.
And then what I was going to say before that is that what's the last place of defense? Your bed with the covers over your head.
Under the covers. Yes, exactly.
How many stories have we come across where adults are still doing that? Like, I threw the covers over my head, hoping it would go away. And usually it does, but sometimes it doesn't.
Sometimes it gets closer while you're not looking, like a cat.
That's right. You pop open. It's like, surprise, I'm still here. So imagine Michael, he's 5 years old here. He's terrified. And so usually the flight or fight response would take him to his parents' bedroom, not the fight response. That was usually my thing, is like, I'm going to get out a bat or Boy Scout knife. And so that's my last defense. Like, I'm going down swinging and stabbing.
Yeah.
So he locks the door. And then you can kind of say maybe he traps himself with this thing at the window, but there's two ways to look at it. So I was going to say there's a little bit of not what they call a hysterical strength, but that adrenaline pumping. It's not like he lifted a car up.
No.
But that's a big, heavy dresser.
Right. It's a big dresser. It's bigger than he is. There is definitely a little bit of Rorschach from The Watchmen when he goes to jail. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'm not locked in here with you. You're locked in here with me. Like, I wonder if something paranormal was happening to you, like what happened to Michael here. And you went as a five-year-old over to your door and just slowly locked it and then turned around like, I'm going to get you. Like, I wonder what would happen if you just took all the fear away and been like, let's go. Come on in here, whatever you are. Let's settle this like man encrypted or whatever, or
We've come across some stories, and I've for years, and I'll mention it here again because it has been a few years since I have mentioned it, but it's apropos. If you believe the story, which I tend to do, and that's just a gut thing when you read a lot of stories like these, and that comes from Jim Harrell's Campfire. And I always point to this because sometimes fear mode not activated.
Yeah.
Fear mode unlocked or not unlocked. And so the fascination is more greater than the fear. And the one is that parade of shadow beings, not men in black, or there might be some connection, but the shadow beings coming out of the wall and traipsing through the kid's bedroom, and he was sleeping on the floor. And he was just like, what is this? And he was so fascinated, he reached up and touched one. And there's other little elements about the story that makes me tend to believe it, or this person's just a great horror writer, is that the reaction was that, you know, these are blacker than black, typical shadow figures, hat men, whatever, crossing through, and there's several of them, and there may have been a female one that he recognized, but they're crossing his room and stepping right by him. He reaches up and grabs one, which they are not prepared for. So to answer your question, it's like, well, what are you doing? You're not supposed to touch us. You're supposed to be afraid of us. We're supposed to observe you. And so when you take that away, what happened was he said it felt very heavy and like thick, blacker than black, soft velvet. It was like a velvety touch. And this thing was kind of shocked, and it slowly rocked back like those old toy punching bags. They were blown up vinyl. On the bottom was a pouch of sand, usually, to weight it.
Yeah, it was like a Weeble. Not that no one is going to know what a Weeble is, but I know you do, my friend.
Oh, sure. So. But also, I don't know if kids play with these things anymore, but their fun is that you could just take your aggression out.
You punch it and it pops back.
He said this thing kind of slowly rocked back like, whoa, what are you doing, kid? And then it righted itself and then continued on its way and disappeared into the wall. So that's a good question. I think a lot of times people just follow their gut. And this gut here of this five-year-old is like, I have a very intense feeling of fear. And so I'm going to lock myself in the room with my sister, also to protect her, to keep this thing from coming inside. So it's outside staring in, but it still is that barrier of an uninvited being.
Another thing I want to say before we move on here, too, that I think is interesting is, you know, you and I, having done the show for so long now, we have friends who see things on the regular.
Right.
And they're psychics, they're mediums, they're remote viewers and stuff like that. And, you know, I always say, based on all the people we've met over the years, of the people who say that they have a gift like that, I truly believe, I think about 20% of them really have something going on. And I think other ones, not necessarily are nefariously deceptive, but I think that they maybe think they're seeing things when they're not. But there's a few people we know that there's no question that weird crap is happening to them all the time and they're seeing stuff. And with those people, when something like this happens, of course, not as a five-year-old child, but like as adults, I know that we have two or three stories where our friends have said to us, ugh, not now, I'm not in the mood, I'm trying to sleep, things like that. And just the thing just goes away. Whatever it is, it just goes away.
Well, no, my favorite of that ilk with an adult, my favorite story is told to me by a very good friend of ours who is a seasoned veteran ghost hunter and paranormal researcher on the side, and had another friend who was also the same, just loved going into famous haunted places and may have even been part of a television production.
Right.
There was an old place, I think it was a hotel perhaps, because this happened in her room, where they'd had some kind of celebration party the night before or maybe the night after their investigation, and lots of libations, a bit of drinking. And she goes back to her room very late, not feeling well. So she's in the bathroom, huddled down by the porcelain throne.
Yes.
The bathroom's spinning, and out of the corner of her eye, she can see this black misty mass starting to form in a corner up near the ceiling, and it started to materialize, and she just kind of looks up and like, not now, not now. And the thing like, I'm sorry, I didn't, that's bad. Sorry about this. Yeah. I'll come back later. And it just,
it
dissolved and went away.
The thing is like, take a shower, get a nap, drink lots of water. I'll be back tomorrow.
Didn't even offer to hold her hair while she was
watching.
But that is, and there might be some power to that, all facetiousness aside.
I do think there is, honestly. I believe that there is, because I do have, it's very Monsters, Inc., but I do believe there's power in the fear, and that it does seem like, and it's something we've come across allegorically and in terms of these stories a lot of times over the years, was that there is power in your fear that helps darker things thrive.
Yeah, there's that energy, right? There's that intense periods of emotional energy, which now, of course, is being tied into the UFO phenomenon as something
That's
to
right.
be harvested. So
very psychological now. So let's do the math a little bit here. Michael says the house was on an incline, right? He didn't specifically say that it had a walkout basement,
yeah.
but there's definitely enough of an incline behind it that his window is pretty high up off the mm-hmm. ground. So his dad, with a stepladder, has to be on the third rung, I think he said, to see in mm-hmm. now. So if we assume his father, who he said was not tall, but he didn't specify, but let's say he's around 5'10", and the stepladder, each step is maybe a foot, then the windowsill is 7 or 8 feet off the ground at that point.
Yeah, that would be my estimation here, because let's say it's a typical 6-foot ladder, you're 5'9", 5'10", and you're on the third rung, and it's tall. Whatever that thing is, wasn't hopping up and down or wasn't standing on a milk crate left outside. So
right.
Michael says this entity was staring down, or at least level, into the room. And if the eyes are, let's say, 24 inches above the father's head, you're looking at a creature that could be up to 8 feet tall. And I know
right.
that sounds crazy, but then how else do you explain this perspective? And then there's always, I love that, that's another typical trope to these stories, or an element. We just talked about another DLO, I believe. One of my favorite stories that have come in for the Halloween submissions years ago, about two kids being at home, and sometimes it's kids, I think, to present themselves. And there's an element to that too, in that whatever this force is easier seen by kids, or they're more helpless in a way. Maybe a softer target, let's say. It was a really heavy snowstorm, and they saw some figure, humanoid male, looking through those old, a lot of the doors in the 70s had the dimpled glass that was usually amber colored a lot.
Yeah, sure, Pizza Hut.
Yeah, so, you're right. So you look through, they saw somebody looking through, and then they realized, like, wow, you'd have to be really tall to be looking down through those small portal windows in the door. You know, that's a good way to gauge height. But here, let's say this windowsill is about 7 or 8 feet off the ground at that point.
Yeah. The other super important thing here, red eyes. I mean,
right.
it's practically a trope at this point, but it's something that comes up for a lot of people in a lot of different encounters. And he doesn't say eye shine. He says they were moving, looking for something. Now, eye shine requires an external light source because it's a reflection,
right.
you know, like a flashlight or something. But these were visible before his dad went outside with the light.
Right.
So here we are back at the Mothman. And in fact, it sounds a lot like some of the Mothman sightings, almost verbatim. Mogador is about 200 miles north of Point Pleasant.
Mm.
I don't know how populated the area is.
Yeah, but a short
direct
flight.
I think it's close enough to Cleveland that it's, you know.
Right. So it could be part of the suburbs for Cleveland. Are we thinking? We'd have to talk to somebody, whether that's considered, because like I said,
right.
you know, there's some debate when we talked about upstate New York and where does upstate
right.
actually begin? And there's a lot of debate by locals of what the definition of that is.
Yonkers.
Okay.
Sorry, that's my New York joke. I'm kidding.
Are we dealing with some kind of urban or suburban sighting of something like a Mothman?
Yeah.
And again, this is the perfect time for it. So this was, you know, based on what we know, about 1974 or early 1975, and the Silver Bridge collapse was 7 or 8 years just prior to this. The Ohio Valley UFO flap had either just happened or could have still been going on, which begs a ton of interesting questions.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking too with the flap going on, and that's its whole thing. In fact, people have been asking us to cover that on the main show, that flap itself, which our friend Rob Kay has covered mm-hmm. extensively when he was still producing, and as have other people pretty well. But there's this idea in my mind anyway, and it's a little bit of a Spielberg-esque idea, but like during the flap, is that just a bunch of tourists? They're all coming down and they're peeking in kids' bedroom windows and wandering around in the woods, and all kinds of like ET type crap is happening. It's weird because it's also strange to think, all right, well, let's go with all the prevailing theories. It's like, well, is this interdimensional travel?
Right.
How they're reducing inertial mass and doing all this sophisticated kind of traveling coming from under the ocean, as we have implied in recent episodes, and all that stuff, all just to go and peek in a kid's bedroom.
Well, Yeah, I know. It's us from the future. And we're somehow we're just creepy voyeurs in the future, even more so.
Right. So it's a pervy dude from the future.
Or is it? Is this boy an ancestor of these beings somehow? Is he important? Or like the abduction phenomenon?
John Connor.
Yeah. Well, is there a reason? You know, there are speculations about when you filter the data and you start seeing like things and making your Venn diagrams, there are some correlations between people who are abducted or claim to be. And why them? You know what I'm saying? Like it's a whole range of people. It's not just farmers out in the middle of nowhere or cows or this and that. It could be anybody. People from all walks of life have reported this in every part of the world. So what's the commonalities here? Why them? Why are these sightings appearing to certain people? Is it just the location, or was that boy and possibly his sister or just children in general, human children, important or interesting to these things? Because I do believe that there's a fascination. Maybe it's their form of TV or entertainment. These like little streaming clips, and they can just pop in and take a look at us because we're so unusual. I mean, would you want to safely, if you had that kind of power, would you pop in and peer into another dimension just to see what it's like?
Not if I'm looking in a child's bedroom. No,
well, but here's the of course, yes. You don't want to, you want an interdimensional.
I might look in the living room and try to see what they're watching on TV.
No, you don't want an interdimensional restraining order. So
retreat to the nearest convenient parallel dimension.
Right. So
Dan Aykroyd.
My point is that why is this happening? What do you want? What is this? Why are they doing this? Well, right. I think it's just curiosity. Why do you, he says, Michael here says he doesn't believe in Bigfoot, but there's tons of stories of Bigfoots and Sasquatch Eye peering into people's homes. They're curious. And I think if you had a split level house or a walk-in basement house, and there's a bunch of Sasquatches living in there, a family, you might peek in too. You know what I'm saying? They don't completely hang around, but like, again, why is this happening? And give us a reason that we can understand.
Right. And here's the other thing, which people aren't going to know if they're not familiar with the Minerva Monster, but it famously looked in the kitchen window.
Yeah.
Minerva, Ohio. So we're outside.
Right. So I think there is some observational thing. I mean, it may be on their end, some scientific possibility. I think with the phenomenon that is the driving point, there is their science behind this. And this is just possibly just mere curiosity, or they're just there unknowingly in a weird way. You know what I'm saying? Like they look surprised that I just came across another story where the person got the sense this, whatever was there, this creature, cryptid or being, was very surprised it was there and very surprised the person could see it.
Yeah.
And so, again, it's like the shadow person walking by like, whoa, you're not supposed to touch us, kid. Hands off. And now you got it all sticky. You've been eating candy in bed. Now my robes, I'm going to have to get it cleaned. But I like the fact that, you know, speaking of science and what's the purpose here, he mentions his dad was a science guy, room for the paranormal, yet he went out there with a gun. But here's the thing. Now you might say like, oh, so he had some room to believe in that, or he was just saying that. It's like, well, no, there's a threat outside. That's what you do.
You just don't want to go empty-handed. Yeah.
Yeah, you never go into the woods generally, into the deep woods, without
something,
your sidearm, because— Yeah, and people say, well, that's not necessary. It's like, yeah, most of the time it isn't, but then sometimes it is. And you just don't want to be out there with a pocket knife. So the unasked question here, if there is any, did this dad believe in monsters? Did he think, what was he going to shoot? And, was it just an 8-foot-tall peeping Tom? Where I would say as a parent, and I am not one, but I certainly can empathize. I've had parents. I was a child also, and I remember that what that's like.
you've been in many of those adjacent relationships.
Yeah, no, look at people's, it's funny. It's like, no, I understand that urge. Now, I can't feel it, but I certainly understand that my dad, if there was a threat, would go outside with a gun. And my grandfather actually did that. But it was a human threat. There's some crazed dude wandering around on the property. And they did have a house with a basement exit, a daylight basement. And he did went out there with a gun and he chased the guy off. But look, he went through World War II. He was not afraid of any man or beast.
Yeah.
But anyway, right. That's the urge, I think, is that no matter what it is, you're going to go check it out. Like why? I would be really upset if I, as a child, describe this, or hearing another child describe this, and the parents are like, go to bed.
Right.
It's you should at least check it out. If there's somebody's, whatever that is, and talking about eye shine, this thing's radiating light. The eyes are radiating light, not reflecting it back. So something, because they were so frightened, I would say it's not their imagination. But I also like, I would also want to hear if this, what the sister's POV is. We didn't get that much in the story.
No, there's not a lot there. There is some discussion about the family talking about this. And I think that's what's interesting, right? Because like, it seems like it's a statement of fact that this happened with the dad, with Michael, with everybody. That tells you that ultimately they accepted that it was a reality. Something happened, even if they couldn't categorize
it. Yeah, I love that part of it. I love it when parents at least consider the possibilities, no matter what your science-minded background, whatever it is that you're taken seriously, even as children.
Yeah.
And it just bugs me when, and I think it's their own fear. I mean, look, it depends on the child too. If they're always making up stories like this, like, okay, maybe it's, you have to view it from that personal experience perspective. But I think there's also some deep-seated fear when you have these fantastical stories that are told by the parents and they get a smack. Like,
yeah,
put your lion. Yeah. And so I don't want to think about this. That's what it is.
Well, so the question is, where do we land on this one? Yeah. We have an 8-foot tall entity with self-luminous red eyes in a high activity corridor of strangeness during a decade of peak anomalies in Ohio, and again, that plays itself into a whole thing of just like, it's something bigger than a flap. You know, a flap, it's a bunch of UFOs. People are seeing lots of UFOs over a period of time, like a high inordinate number of them. But maybe there's more that goes along with that. Stuff happening on the ground, stuff happening in the woods, close encounters. Like, it's a general amp up of the paranormal zeitgeist. It's their world is intersecting with ours in a more major way at this moment in time for some strange reason. And maybe this was just something cast off from that.
Yeah. It's a great intersection here, a rogue wave, a sine wave of being in the right place at the right time in the right decade and the right age.
And the kids always see the stuff too.
That's what I'm saying another thing that's obvious is that, kids are paying much more attention. We're talking at the beginning of this about their world, and their world is all of outdoors. You want to go outside. They're not as distracted. They're not with their nose down in a screen. That's maybe why adults don't see as many things. I'd be curious to know nobody's done the data as far as maybe they have, but where there's a demographic breakdown of, do kids see more things like this than adults? What types of kids, urban or suburban or rural? All these different categories of social science that can be applied to these sightings. I'd be curious to know, do kids see more things than adults? I would bet that the answer is yes. You don't want to see stuff. You don't have time for that. You got to go to work. Dinners are almost ready on the table. So give me a few quick thoughts on the mundane explanations. Are we going to go to owl? Is it just perched on the windowsill? Well, I don't know if there's enough windowsill for it to be perched. Certainly you've seen that clip now where an owl flies through some guy's window and is perched on the curtain rod. It's just mining. Yeah. It's hanging. It didn't feel threatened. Owls, they have that chill that is just supernatural in a way too. It's like, it's not phased. Other birds be like, whoa, there's a human here. And so he doesn't know how to get it out of his house. And he takes us like a Swiffer mop and he gets it to perch and walk onto the mop. And then he gently lowers it. And then he puts it out the window. And finally the owl flies off. So we have owl and it's like, I don't want to go to owl. So what do you think about the mundane explanations? What do you think your reaction would be? What are your quick summations here?
Well, I think that something was definitely there. I don't think that Michael and his sister were imagining things. I think it's a pretty intense level of fear to block your door with a big piece of furniture. What it was, I can't say, but I think in terms of the mundane, I would lean more towards an owl than any other kind of thing like that. But it feels different to me. This feels different. And because of the time and the place, I believe it's different. And the thing that I would say to listeners of our show, if you have kids, when they tell you they've seen or experienced something strange, start with believing them.
The Astonishing Dead Letter Office is hosted by Scott Philbrick and Forrest Burgess and is executive produced by Tess Feifel. The show is edited and mixed by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. The theme is based on the Astonishing Legends theme by Judson Crane at Founder Music, arranged by Alan Carissia, who composes all the other music in the show. Tommy Beaver Design created the logo. The announcer is John Bolton. That's me. Stories are lightly edited for length, content, and readability, but otherwise presented as they're sent to us. We're always looking for more dead letters, so if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, email it to deadletteroffice@astonishinglegends.com. Please include how you would like to be credited. First name only, first name last initial, anonymous, a pseudonym. Let us know. Due to the number of emails coming in, we often cannot respond, but we do read them all. No part of the show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.
Doing taxes the old way meant handing everything off and just hoping things were moving. But now, you can feel confident your taxes are being handled right with Intuit TurboTax. Now you match with a TurboTax full-service expert. Just upload your documents right in the app, and boom, they take it from there. Start to finish, you've got a dedicated expert working your return. They check every deduction and credit to help you get the best possible outcome, so you can feel confident you're getting every dollar you deserve. And now you're not guessing what's happening, you're seeing it happen. TurboTax gives you real-time updates on your expert's progress while you go about your day. Run errands, grab a coffee, live your life. You're always in the loop. And if a question pops up, you get unlimited expert help at no extra cost, even on nights and weekends during tax season. Taxes are finally transparent, easier, and handled. Visit TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax full-service experts. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile app.
My perfect day has sand, salt, water, and friends. But my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can take me out of the moment. Now I'm all in with clearer skin thanks to Skyrizi. Risankizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150-milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. With Skyrizi, most people saw 90% clearer skin, and many were even 100% plaque-free at 4 months. Skyrizi is just 4 doses a year after 2 starter doses.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions, increased infections, or lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, get checked for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor about any flu-like symptoms or vaccines.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin. And that means everything. Nothing is everything. Ask your doctor about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis. Visit Skyrizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Are you a fraud-paying American? It's a fact that 1 in 4 honest, hard-working, tax-paying Americans has been a victim of identity theft. With LifeLock Identity Theft Protection, though, if your identity is stolen, they fix it, guaranteed, and get you your money back. Last year, the IRS flagged over $16 billion in refunds for identity fraud. That's billions of dollars that could come from your salary, overtime, or second job. But this year, you don't need to stay a victim. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second for your personal information and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. And if your information does fall into the wrong hands, only LifeLock has U.S.-based restoration specialists who are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. Because this tax season, fraud-paying American is something no American should have to claim. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's 40% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply. Are you a fraud-paying American? 1 in 4 tax-paying Americans has been a victim of identity fraud. With LifeLock, if your identity is stolen, they fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Last year, billions in refunds were stolen. Could be from your salary, overtime, or second job. Gone. But this year, you don't need to stay a victim. Because this tax season, fraud paying American is something no American should have to claim. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
This is Teddy Mellencamp from Two Teas in a Pod with Teddy Mellencamp and Tamara Judge. There's a new season of 90 Day the Single Life, and it's hotter than ever.
If you've never seen 90 Day before, this is the one that will get you hooked. Their marriages crumbled. Now, 8 singles are taking the leap and stepping back out to the scariest place of all, the dating world.
There will be exciting first dates, steamy hookups, big letdowns, and potential love waiting in the most unexpected places.
Don't miss a new season of 90 Day The Single Life, Monday at 8 on TLC.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.